When the name Sir Keith Hancock is mentioned, I immediately recalled my school days reading a history book called Australia. It was published in 1930 and was considered as one of the great works on the country. Sufficiently so that when I was at school in the 1960s, it was still there in its dog-eared paperback form around the classroom. But how widely this Australian historian, Sir Keith Hancock, is known today, well, depends perhaps on what era you grew up in. Keith Hancock didn't concentrate solely on Australian history. He spent his time in Britain, where he excelled in the history of the British Commonwealth, spent time working in Italy and South Africa, and was sent on a mission to mediate the political problems of decolonisation in Uganda. And more on this later. In his 90 years of life, Keith Hancock definitely achieved a great deal, including two knighthoods, one from the Brits and one from the Australian government. When he was a youngster at university in Melbourne, he was asked what he was intending to do for a living. He answered he wasn't thinking about a living, but for making a life. The living would follow. Appropriate sentiments, I believe, but in case I'm wrong, I'm sitting in the Melbourne studio historian Jim Davidson, who through his research for his book, A Three-Cornered Life, the historian W.K. Hancock, can shed some more light on Sir Keith. Jim is a Principal Fellow at the Australian Centre in the School of Historical Studies at the University of Melbourne and is also an editor and writer. Jim, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello, John.
Well, what a significant character we're dealing with here. It's very hard to know where to begin. He comes out of a group of historians. He has a life that shapes not only the way Australians view their history, but also the wider Commonwealth. How does one begin to talk about the country he wrote about and the calling he had?
Well, I suppose part of the answer is that he belonged to that generation of Australians who still saw themselves as British, even if it was British with a small b, as Hancock used to put it. In other words, he was very conscious of being Australian, but he was also conscious that as an ambitious man, if he really wanted to achieve things, he couldn't do it here in the period between the wars. That's when he was born in 1898, and he dies in 1988, aged 90. So off he goes, and on the way here I thought there are others like this, like the great prehistorian Gordon Child, or Herbert Heaton, who goes from Adelaide to America and becomes a major international economic historian. And none of the Australian historians who remained really had very much of an international reputation. People like Crawford or Shan or Stephen Roberts did a bit with his book at The House That Hitler Built, but he's really the exception.
Now, the title of your book is also intriguing, Three-Cornered Life.
It sounds like a hat or something, doesn't it? A tricorn. But I thought of that because there are a couple of ways in which it's true. Many people will have heard of Hancock's autobiography, which is called Country and Calling. And he saw himself as subject to a tension between the calling, as he put it, meaning the impulse to write history at its very best, which he felt would necessarily take him overseas, and his real tie to Australia. In fact, he would describe himself sometimes as a deserter. He was really torn on this, and this is why he came back in 1926 once to Adelaide for 8 years, and he tried to come back in 1949 to the ANU, and then came back finally for the last 30 years of his life in 1957. But in fact, it's a bit more complicated than that, because he was also very attached to Italy and could speak perfect Italian in the best Tuscan accent. And later in life, Italy gets a bit knocked off by South Africa. So there's always, in a sense, a triangle. And I put it in the book that it's as though Australia is his mother country, England is his wife, and where he spends most of his career, and Italy his mistress.
But is there a dark side to that as well?
Yes, there is a flip side to it, and a flip is perhaps not quite the right word given its ambiguity, but there is a dark side to it in the sense that he felt in some ways incomplete. He felt, as indeed quite a lot of men of that time did, that if they didn't go to war, and if they perhaps hadn't killed even, they were not real men. I've struck this attitude a few times. It's one which, on the whole, we've got rid of, but it was quite a common cultural attitude at that time. So he felt he hadn't been tested, you see. And then the related one was that His wife had a hysterectomy and he wasn't able to have children, and that really hurt him. So that in those two ways he felt that he wasn't the complete man. And so his life was three-cornered rather than four-cornered in that respect.
He becomes a remarkably distinguished historian. That post-World War I year period, I guess, does give people an impetus to be connected to the wider world. For the first time, Australians had been overseas, seen the wider world. There's a cultural milieu that, I guess, helps foster that. But he was knighted both for his work in England and Australia. What sort of an historian was he?
Well, the thing that the thing that's interesting about Hancock is his great curiosity, firstly, so that he can't stay away from Germany going through the Great Inflation when he first gets to England, or to Italy under Mussolini, or indeed from Africa as it's emerging much, much later into independence. And the other thing is his capacity for constant renewal and shifting his focus, so that this man who begins as an empire loyalist ends up by 1980 being a strong environmentalist and almost equally strong, curtailed only by declining physical energy in his 80s, advocating a non-nuclear neutral Australia. Now, there's no American alliance.
There's some interesting contradictions here. Look, I just got one anecdote from my own experience. I remember at HSC history, you know, my copy of Hancock, and one or two teachers looking down on it with some disdain. He was not really acceptable to the progressives of the 60s.
Well, I think because he'd gone overseas and spent so much of his life overseas, and of course, from an office actually in the cabinet offices in Whitehall, had directed the writing of the whole mobilisation of Britain during the war as it was happening and after it was happening. So he did have a slightly Englishy feel to him, and his voice was beautifully positioned between an Australian accent and an English precision. And I joke in the book that he was probably the only man in Australia who said, "Histo." With the full three syllables.
Let's talk about his remarkable three-cornered life in sections. That history of Australia that he wrote, published in 1930, was still being used in schools in the 1960s. How significant a book was it, and what sort of history was it?
Well, it wasn't really history in the conventional sense. I mean, it appeared in a series of books which were explicating different countries. There were about a dozen or 15 in the series. So that it was basically, it was published in London and it was aimed at an international audience and it was meant to introduce Australia. So it is really, if it is history, it is history of the present. But it is partly a descriptive account and an analytical account of what Australia is like now. There's no sense that you get the gold rushes and the land struggles, the Federation movement, all that sort of stuff. That's totally absent from it.
So it's an essayist's encounter.
That's right.
It's almost going back to Vance Palmer in a sense, is it?
Well, Vance Palmer is really almost a contemporary. Vance Palmer is only 10 years older than Hancock. And Vance Palmer still had quite wasn't so very far advanced in his career when this book appeared in 1930. But yes, it does. It has a lot of very crisp judgments in it, and that's why it had such a long life. And the only thing really that toppled it was the way that Australia went through a seismic change in the mid-60s, and then Donald Horne came along with The Lucky Country, which, while it wasn't written as well, was absolutely up to the minute and gave a very good perspective on Australia, which has really only become obsolete in the last 10, 15 years.
Historiography is also emerging in Australia at this time, when he is in his youth as an historian, and out of him and his colleagues come a whole generation of people like Max Crawford, but then, of course, you go on to Manning Clark and Geoffrey Blainey and Geoffrey Searle and many others. So there was a period here in which Australian historiography was becoming self-conscious. We talk about the Melbourne School, for example.
Yeah. Well, he, of course, he went to the University of Melbourne, but, I mean, once he left it as an undergraduate at the age of 21, he never really was associated with Melbourne again. So, in a way, he's not part of the Melbourne School.
But is he influenced by those same currents? I guess it's...
Earlier, remember. I mean, he's 17 years older than Manning Clark. He's born in 1898, and Manning Clark is born in 1915. So this is partly why, if you like, Hancock is the tadpole turning into the frog. That he's got one foot outside Australia and one foot in. I mean, it makes much more sense when one realises how long his life was and where he was in the first part of it.
So his life flowers outside of that context where he's Manning Clark, he's younger,
right. I mean, his
contemporary
first book,
flowers inside.
That's right. That's right. And that his first books, I mean, even Australia is published in England, but of course that's not so unusual at that time. But his first book is actually on the Italian Risorgimento and was one of the very first books published by Faber and Faber.
There's something else interesting too about the, and I'll get back to the Risorgimento in a moment, but the links to Manning Clark. I mean, they both have similar academic careers early on, Melbourne Grammar, Balliol College.
Right.
And they both are children of the church.
That's right. And they are both really, Hancock less than Manning actually, rather conservative early in their life, and they become much, much more radical the older they become.
Does the church remain an influence for Hancock? The way, in some ways, it was a dark influence for Clark. He struggles with it right through.
That's right. Yes, and he can't quite square it. And of course, partly they have very different temperaments. I mean, Manning was somebody who was much more a doubter, and a doubter about his own personality and his own motives, and constantly wanting to align himself with novelists. And the way he resolves this partly is to create a great myth about Australia, whereas Hancock was rather more serene and untroubled and more inclined to be analytical and objective and not to wear his heart on his sleeve. So that temperamentally they're almost poles apart.
Yet and there's a moral vision infuses both of them.
Yes, except I think it's less explicit in Hancock actually.
Yes, it comes out in his life.
Oh yes, it does come out in his life, and it is there. But I think that Manning advances it to the point of heroes and villains in a way that Hancock never does.
Was always more restrained. He was an Anglican, not a Methodist.
Well, that's true. In fact, I would go better than that. And when I was asked in England once, was he a Christian? I said, no, he was an Anglican. And what I meant was that Anglicanism for him functioned as a kind of civic religion,
yes,
and a kind of code of conduct in a way.
Let's talk about him as a remarkable man and some of the adventures of his life. You mentioned Italy and his enchantment with Italy and the Risorgimento and Mussolini, but he also, as you said, went into Germany at the time of the Weimar Republic and was fascinated by social change in Germany to the extent that he even went back after Hitler's election to power.
That's right. Well, that was fascinating because he'd just left Adelaide and gone to Birmingham, and the first summer that he has free, 6 months after he arrives, off he goes to Germany to a town called Marburg, which was a very conservative town where he'd spent 3 or 4 months earlier in 1930. And he goes and frequents a tavern which is frequented by Nazi thugs and possibly SS men. I don't really know enough details about it. And he knows enough German to be able to speak to them properly, and they start to brag to him about how they're beating up intellectuals and Jews. And, of course, there's a lot of anti-Jewish propaganda and so on. And he says in one of his obscure essays, he said, the night came when I could bear it no more. I pushed myself back from the table and I said, right, I am a Jew. General Monash, who defeated some of your best generals, is a Jew. All Australians are Jews. We are the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And he stormed out of the room and next day left Germany and, in fact, never went there again.
This is bold and uncharacteristic, or bold and in some ways characteristic?
Well, you're a little bit of both, of course. Uncharacteristic in the sense that he was basically a very controlled man, but he did have moments of cold fury, and I think that one must just about take the cake.
Let's talk very briefly about why he is recognised internationally. And a large amount of this flows out of two major works he undertook. One during the war and post-war, writing a civil history of Britain during the wars under commission from the British. And also his work of a similar nature, telling the story of the Commonwealth, also under a commission. And both of these works have become regarded as the sort of standard authorities for that period of time.
That's right, particularly, obsolete in some ways, because there are always historians who can improve on particular parts of any historical work later, given, you know, new information that comes to light. But that is right. The civil histories of the Second World War, as they're called, Hancock wrote only one volume himself, but it was the keystone volume. And in addition, he supervised and determined the nature of all the other ones. So that was really what he got his British knighthood for.
He eventually, I'll skip a little here, Jim, because we're going to run out of time, and I'd love to get to the latter stages of his career. Can you segue for us from Britain back to Australia, from that the high point of his intellectual contribution in Britain to his coming back to Australia and the ANU?
Well, basically, he was appointed by the ANU as one of the four maestros, as they called them, the four advisors, which included Florey and Mark Oliphant and an anthropologist. And it was assumed that he would head the Research School of Social Sciences. But in fact, there were a series of misunderstandings, and Hancock was very keen to recruit his own people personally and not prepared to really clinch the deal with the ANU until the people he wanted would come with him. And the ANU got sick of that, and they said, well, I'm sorry, we're not interested in having you. And this was a mortal blow to him. But as it happened, the ANU realised, after 1949, that they really did need him. And so there was a ginger courtship, and nobody was appointed to the post that Hancock had been considered for. And in 1957, he returned. And then once he returned, and once he had finished his great two-volume biography of Smuts by 1968, he began to get interested in the environmental issues in Australia. He'd begun to show some interest of that, and you can see it in Australia of 1930, but it really blossoms in the first regional environmental history of Australia, which is Discovering Monero, which appears in 1972 when he's 74.
And then he moves into an environmental consciousness that's also linked to the nuclear disarmament movement
as
well.
That's right. Yes, and he does. But and this comes out in lectures and in pamphlets and so on. But as I say, there's no major work there because, frankly, he's running out of puff now. I mean, he's, by the time we get to 1980, he's 82.
We've talked about his life and achievements, or just a few of them. What was he like as a person?
Rather austere and a little bit intimidating. I mean, I felt intimidated by him when I was 40, and that even his silences had a certain edge to them. But he had a very nice sense of humour and a quirkiness, and this is really what humanised him and made him interesting. And I mean, to think of somebody like Hancock writing to his brother-in-law, the Anglican Dean of Wangaratta, and on the and after he's folded the letter, he picks up the name of his brother-in-law, Percy Dicker, and he writes on it, Percy the Dick of Wang Vic. And it's typical of his sort of fairly
Jim
anarchic
Davidson,
history.
Thanks so much. We've run out of time. That's it for LNL, but stick around for the news on ABC Radio National.